Okay, so this is Bio 231, and this is your second lecture. We're going to finish up Chapter 1 and move into Chapter 2 today. I just want to make sure that everybody realizes that the first quiz in lab is going to cover anything in Unit 1, which is anything about the microscope, how to use a microscope, parts of a microscope, imaging planes, which we talked about last time. How many planes are there? We'll start that with something really simple. How many planes are there? How many imaging planes are there? Okay, you can say on the number of fingers that you have on one hand.
Five.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. But there are three imaging planes, but you could say four if you take a standard imaging plane that, say, sagittal and angulated. You could say an angulated plane is another one. We call those oblique. But there are basically three imaging planes. An angulated one would be an oblique plane. Okay, and body cavities we'll go over in just a second. Let's see, this is what I wanted to do. I want to turn the lights down just a little bit so you can see the slides a little bit better. Not those, that's good. That's even better. How's that? Can you see the slides as well as your lectures? Good. Okay, so now I haven't heard that anybody could not log into Blackboard. So that is a good thing. If you're not logging into Blackboard, that is a huge problem in this class because, remember, it's a hybrid class. You have to log in. So if you're not able to log in, you got to get in touch with me and we got to figure out how to do that. All right? Usually it's just a little problem with your password. All right, so let's get going with this. I'm going to go to Merib Chapters. Okay. Images. All right, so we talked about the different kinds of anatomy, but how are we going to study anatomy in this class of all the different kinds of ways? Yeah, systemic anatomy is really good. In lab, we'll spend a little time with microscopic anatomy because we're going to look at histology and tissues, but mostly it's going to be gross anatomy at the level of systemic anatomy or systematic anatomy. I don't think this is our class. I better shut that down so somebody can't get in there and mess around. Okay. All right, so did you all find where you can get the lecture notes from in Blackboard? Hopefully so. If you have a problem with that, make sure you see me. All right, so you know the difference between anatomy and physiology, different levels of organization. And what's the building block of life? It's the cell. Yeah, really good. All right, so that's the structural and functional unit of life. That's the cell. So we're going to start pretty close to cell after we get done with some of these things right here. All right, so I think we got done talking about anatomical position. And in anatomical position, which way are your thumbs pointing or facing? Outwards, okay? Now, outward is not a really good anatomical term, so we actually have to learn what that means when the thumbs are pointing outward. So that's why we have these directional terms right here. And in Blackboard, you have some interactive exercises to understand some of these terms. So let's go over these terms. I don't have a really good picture. There we go. That's easier to see. Directional terms. Anterior, posterior, same as front and back in anatomical position. Anterior is going to be the front of your body. Posterior is going to be the back of the body. Usually these terms are used in relationship to each other. So two structures. All right. So let's just say your nose compared to your heart is what? Your nose is in front of, right? So it's anterior to your heart. So usually we pick two structures and tell what the relationship is between those two structures. All right, so your heart would be what compared to your nose? Your heart would be posterior. In terms of anterior, posterior, that's how we would use those terms. But it might also be right and left a little bit. It might be some other terms, right? It's just not one, so I have to be careful how I phrase the question. All right, superior, inferior. All right, we could use those same two structures once again. Superior doesn't mean better or worse. It just means on top of in anatomic position. In anatomic position, what's on the floor? Is my head on the floor? Nope, my feet are on the floor. So that's as low as you can get is the floor. So my nose is superior to my heart. It just means it's above it. Again, two structures, what's the relationship? So my heart is inferior to my nose. But don't forget, your nose is also what? Anterior to your heart. So it all depends on what dimension that you're talking about. So context is very important as well. Okay. Cranial and caudal is very similar to superior and inferior. All right. So cranial means literally up toward your brain. Caudal means literally down toward your tail. But does a human have a tail? Not really. So it's really more appropriate for other kinds of animals like cats and dogs, right, and mice and things like that that have a tail. But you can imagine where your tail is, right? If you were to have one, it would be down at the bottom of your spinal cord. So cranial means up toward your head, and caudal means down lower. Kind of means inferior, right, for the human body. Yeah. Yeah, it really does. A good way, place to use that would be between the end of your spinal cord and your head. That's where it makes sense in the human body. After that, it sort of doesn't make sense. Okay. But in other animals, it makes perfect sense because they're quadrupeds, because they have a different body orientation. Their anatomic position is radically different compared to human. All right, medial and lateral. This is good. Medial means toward midline. So draw a line right in the middle that's going to separate your body on a mid-sagittal plane into right and left parts, equal right and left parts, like right down between the nostrils and your nose, between your two front teeth, right through the middle of your belly button, all right? That is a nice midline. So anything that's closer to that midline is called medial. Anything farther to the outside is what we call lateral. So if we look at our fingers, like the thumb compared to the little finger, right, the thumb is lateral, right? So that's really the word you want to use. You don't want to say to the outside, you want to say lateral. And of course, that only makes perfect sense if what? You're in anatomic position. If you're not, if you're relaxed like that, then your thumb has a different orientation, and you just have to remember, you can't orient, work your way around through different parts of the body unless you're in anatomic position, at least conceptually in your mind, yeah. Okay. Well, we could use something else, but I like medial and lateral because the heart is right on midline. The lungs are going to be more toward the outside or lateral. I will try to be as specific as possible so you have only one correct answer. Yeah. So you really do have to think because sometimes there's more than one correct answer for two organs. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Proximal and distal. I think this is the hardest one to appreciate. Think again of some center line in your body, but maybe not a line, but just a point. Okay, just some center region in your body. Something that's closest to that central point in your body is what we call medial. Anything farther away from that central point is distal. Oh no, what did I say? I meant to say proximal for some close point in your body. That's proximal. Something far away is distal. So let's compare a couple joints, for instance, like the elbow and the wrist. All right, the elbow is closer to some center location in your body, so that's proximal compared to your wrist. Your wrist is distal. It's farther away from some center location in your body. Okay? So we were talking about the nose and the heart before. It would not be a good terminology to use proximal and distal in that kind of situation. It just wouldn't make sense. Right and left wouldn't make sense. But superior, inferior makes sense, right? Anterior, posterior makes sense. So depending on the relationship of the two organs, some of these directional terms make sense and others don't. And maybe more than one pair of terms makes sense for two organs. All right, so let's look at that proximal and distal again. You have blood vessels that connect to the heart. Now, where is the heart? Is it in your periphery someplace, or is it very centrally located? It's very centrally located. And then there's a blood vessel that goes all the way out to your wrist right here, all right, and that's going to be a radial artery. So let's think of proximal and distal. Let's talk about that radial artery in the heart. The heart is what compared to the radial artery? Is it proximal or distal? The heart is proximal, and that radial artery is distal. And as a matter of fact, a lot of times in a clinic or hospital, you'll just call that a distal pulse or a distal artery because it's what? It's far away from some center location in your body. All right. Okay. Last one, superficial and deep. That's easy to appreciate. We could use a nose and the heart again for this relationship. Superficial means on the surface. If it's deep, it's going to be into the interior of an organ or the interior of your body. So your heart compared to your nose is what? Is it on the surface or is it deep? It's deep. So your heart is deep compared to your nose. Or even better analogy or better way of saying is your integument, right? The skin on your nose is very superficial, right? It's right on the surface of your body. So the integument is superficial compared to the heart. So that's how you would use those terms. All right, you have a lot of good exercises in Blackboard for that. Body planes, we talked about already, I think. Okay, here, oh, let me drag this over here. I want it over here more. Let me arrange some of these windows. All right, so your three imaging planes. What will separate your body into a superior and inferior part? Superior and inferior part. That's that transverse plane. What separates your body into right and left parts? Okay, sagittal plane. And right and left are proper anatomical terms if you want to describe how to move in somebody, because you all could raise your left hand, right? That's different than your right hand. And, oh, don't laugh. Guess what? People make mistakes all the time, unfortunately. And someone goes in maybe to amputate some digits with their fingers because people have lost them, maybe due to diabetes, right, infection or something, and if you remove somebody's digits on their left hand when you should have removed them from the right hand, that's a huge problem, right? That's really sad. So you got to know your right and left for sure, okay? And the frontal plane separates what parts of your body from each other? Yeah, anterior and posterior. So now you're using good anatomic terms for those things. And parasagittal just means a sagittal plane that's off the perfect midline of the body. Mid-sagittal plane is right smack in the middle. And right smack in the middle, if we use a mid-sagittal plane, the right side of your body pretty much is a mirror image of the left side of the body. In some organs, it's pretty much exact. In other organs, it doesn't work very well. Okay, but there is symmetry, so we call that bilateral symmetry. Usually if you have a thumb on one side of the body, you have a thumb on the other. You got an eyeball on one side of the body, you got an eyeball on the other side in terms of right and left. So there's nice bilateral symmetry. That's a way that we speak about paired organs. Okay, and then here we have oblique. This is angulated. So I think in your textbook they have a picture of a banana. Where's that banana at? Used to have a picture of a banana. There's no banana? I don't see it. Okay, I don't see it. So what the heck is this oblique? Well, let's start with sagittal. Okay, so here's a sagittal plane, and it's going to cut through your heart, right, as you go through your chest, all right, but you should kind of already know, maybe just from watching TV and movies and things like that, what side is your heart mostly on? Is it right smack in the middle? It's kind of mostly on the left because it's angulated, okay? It doesn't sit straight up and down. It's kind of like a triangle, but it kind of moves like that. The tip of the triangle is over to the left like that. So it doesn't sit exactly on a sagittal plane or a transverse plane or a coronal plane. It's angulated. So if people want to get a really nice picture of the heart, they have to angulate the imaging study so it lines up with the angle of the heart. So if you deviate from strictly a sagittal or transverse or what plane is this? A frontal plane. If you deviate from transverse, sagittal, or coronal plane, we call that an oblique plane, which means it's angulated. Right? And different organs require different angulations because they are differently angled inside the body. So sagittal, transverse, and frontal are the three basic planes. These are just little modifications of those three basic planes. Okay, body regions. Anatomic terminology is pretty precise when it comes to these different body regions. Okay, so let's take a look at, here's a pretty good slide. So here you can see your head and your neck, right? This is your trunk right here. All right, and your arms and legs are what we call appendages. So you have two upper appendages, a right and left upper appendage. You have a right and left lower appendage as well. And the trunk can be broken down into thoracic cavity and abdominal pelvic cavity right here, or different regions. Okay, so let's look at some cavities. Your appendages don't have cavities. Your arms and legs don't have cavities. They're loaded, they're filled completely with muscles and bones and nerves and things like that. You don't have any special kinds of major organs in appendages, but you do have major organs that take care of your body in what we call the axial part of your body, which includes the head and the trunk right here. There are some major cavities. So there is a posterior cavity and an anterior cavity. The posterior, right, we can see in this gold color. How did I do? Gold? Green? Gold? Gold is good. Okay. Now, you notice just a little bit of a complication on this slide right here because it's not labeled posterior. What is it labeled? Dorsal. Okay, so posterior and dorsal mean exactly the same thing. And people interchange those terms back and forth, sometimes even in the same sentence. And so you just kind of have to stop and think what dorsal is in terms of the anterior-posterior orientation. That's like being in Switzerland someplace. What's funny about there? You might listen to a newscast, and somebody will be interviewing somebody, and the question will be asked in German, and the answer will be in French. All right? You got to know both languages. Well, same thing in anatomy. Okay? Sometimes you just have to be familiar with more than one language, and dorsal means the exact same thing as posterior. And ventral, the ventral cavity right here in red, that's the same thing as anterior cavity, right? So dorsal and ventral go together, anterior, posterior go together. So in this dorsal body cavity, this gold compartment, we have basically just nervous tissue. We've got the brain and spinal cord. So those are cavities that are filled with your brain. So we call that the cranial cavity. And the vertebral cavity contains the spinal cord. So cavities have cavities inside them. So the dorsal cavity can be broken down into two other cavities. And this ventral cavity here can be broken down into thoracic cavity and abdominal cavity. A nice line of demarcation is the diaphragm right here. That's an important muscle for breathing, for respiration, the mechanics of inhalation and exhalation. And in the abdominal cavity, we have digestive organs and other organs that maintain certain functions inside your body, like the liver and pancreas, helps regulate glucose in your blood. We find these organs in the abdominal cavity. And there's no nice line of demarcation. There's no structure that separates the abdominal cavity from the pelvic cavity. Pelvic cavity might contain a few digestive system organs, but also reproductive organs over here, for instance, like uterus, prostate gland, things of that nature. But when we get to the skeletal system, we'll see how they develop this line from a couple landmarks that make up the hip bone. We'll get to that in plenty of time. So anything that's in the abdominal cavity can move into the pelvic cavity very freely because it's really one cavity. Or if anything that's in the pelvic cavity can move up into the abdominal cavity because there's nothing separating it, like the separation here between abdominal and thoracic cavity. So sometimes we think of this as just one cavity. So this takes us to nomenclature. In anatomy, we can make up words, and it's legal to do that as long as you spell them properly. We can take two different terms and put them together, make one word out of it, as long as we put an O between them, just the letter O. So, for instance, if we're talking about this big cavity right here that's made up of the abdominal and pelvic cavity, we could call that the abdominopelvic cavity. So we cut off this N-A-L, change this I to an O, and put pelvic at the end of abdominal, then we're talking about this whole cavity here because, for instance, if there is an infection in this area, it would affect both of these cavities, so that would be the abdominal pelvic cavity. We would want to talk about it that way. Okay. There is also another term for the abdominal pelvic cavity if they're joined together, and that is called the peritoneal cavity. And I don't know if I see this on the slide anywhere. It's got to be on the slide someplace. I just don't see it. Peritoneal cavity, right, is abdominopelvic. Both of them put together. All right, so again, cavities can have subcavities, and sometimes we put subcavities together and come up with another name, like peritoneal cavity. All right, the thoracic cavity, right, it's in your thorax, superior to the diaphragm, right? And furthermore, there's all kinds of important organs in the thoracic cavity, and they're found within their own little minor cavities. So the thoracic cavity can be broken down into other important cavities. The lungs right here, which are lateral, positioned laterally in the thoracic cavity, this is what we call the pleural cavity. So anytime you hear that word pleural or pleurisy, that's going to refer to the lungs. Pleurisy is an infection of this cavity right here. All right. The heart is in its own little cavity. We call that the pericardial cavity. All right. And you notice that there is a cavity that's right above the pericardial cavity. If we add the pericardial cavity with this little one that's right above it, then we call this the mediastinum. The mediastinum is the cavity that's centrally located in the thoracic cavity. All right, and that's kind of like integumentary. What did I say about integumentary system last time? That's a good test question because you never heard of integument system. Right, you probably heard of skeletal system and muscle system, nervous system before this class, but probably not integumentary. You probably heard of thoracic cavity, abdominal cavity. Maybe, though, you haven't heard of mediastinum. Right, so that just is a good check to see if you're studying. So that's a good test question, right? Because it tells me that you're educated. Mediastinum is very particular. All right, you think that's a very important cavity. Why or why not? People are shaking their head, yeah, why? What do you find in the mediastinum? You have the heart, very important organ. I wouldn't want to go more than 3 seconds without my heart, okay? And even the superior part of the mediastinum has the great blood vessels coming off the aorta. Vessels, the pulmonary vessels that go to the lungs, the aorta, okay? A bunch of veins that bring blood back to the heart. Newborn babies sometimes don't have those blood vessels connected up in the right location and in the right order, and a physician orders a mediastinal scan to find out what the arrangement of those blood vessels are so that they can be reconnected with, right, open chest surgery, right? So mediastinum is used all the time. Don't ignore that cavity, very important cavity. All right, so we have major cavities and then minor cavities that can make them up. You have good drag and drop exercises in this diagram right here. This is something that you're responsible for the first quiz, the first lab quiz. All right, so make sure you know mediastinum is in what cavity? Is the mediastinum in the abdominal cavity? Is it in the pleural cavity? No, it's in the thoracic cavity, or you could say what other cavity? It's in the ventral body cavity. Exactly right. Okay, so you should be able to go up and down in those different terms. Okay, what else do I want to say about that slide? Probably that's pretty good. Okay, let's look over here. Okay, what are some funny things about these regional terms in anatomy? Ooh, let me just bonk out back over here. Okay, let's go to anatomic position. Here we have somebody in anatomic position. So here we have the two upper appendages, right and left. All right, and if I point to this region right here, right where the cursor is, between the elbow and the wrist, what part of the body is that? Is that the arm? You might want to say, oh, well, it kind of looks like an arm to me. But for proper anatomic terminology, that's not an arm. That is a forearm. Between elbow and wrist is forearm. Between elbow and shoulder, that's your arm. Okay? A little particular. Here are your lower appendages. Same kind of thing. Between your hip and your knee, that kind of looks like a leg to me. But who knows what that really is? That is called the thigh. That's not your leg, that's your thigh. Where your leg is, between your knee and your ankle, that is your leg in proper anatomical language. All right, so there's some little funny quirks in that way of thinking. Okay, so there's body cavities. All right, we talked pretty much about everything for chapter one. Okay, that's pretty good. There's maybe just one thing that eventually, these are good exam, I guess I do need to talk about this. These are good exam figures right here that talk about different regions of the body. These are pretty important, and it might seem like just a lot of busy work to be able to label these different regions right here, but this is pretty important in the sense that it can make your life easier if you know the proper terms for these different body regions, because sometimes organs are named or pieces of organs are named after the body regions. So for instance, your armpit right here, that's the axillary region. All right, there's a blood vessel that starts at your heart, which is the aorta, and then it turns into a subclavian, and then as it goes right on top of your armpit right here, it becomes the axillary artery, right? So if you learn this terminology, you learn a lot of vascular anatomy and neuroanatomy, right, at the same time. So that's really important to know. Okay, so what are some things maybe that I want to point out? Optic, right, or orbital, that's for your eyes. And on the back, on the next slide, I don't know if they have one pointing to the ear. Do they have one pointing to the ear? Ah, they do. Some textbooks had this wrong for years and years and years. They had optic pointing to the ear right here. I know, that's kind of funny. That's good if you think that's funny, because that's not, that has nothing to do with your eye. That's your ear. That's the otic area. Otic has to do with hearing, right? Orbital or optic has to do with the eyes. And as a matter of fact, if a physician or a practitioner checks out your eyes, what's that little instrument they use to look inside your eyeball? That's an ophthalmoscope, a different word. They also use an instrument to look inside your ears. Not the same instrument. That's called an otoscope, right? So learning these body regions also tells you what the proper name for different kinds of equipment are. Okay, cervical is just the neck region. Thoracic is what? Just your around your thoracic compartment. Lumbar region is below the diaphragm. Okay, so be familiar with these. They got some good drag and drop exercises to maybe make it not quite so tedious in learning these things. Also, this diagram right here I see is color-coded. I see different colors right here. But remember, a test is just going to be grayscale. It's going to be photocopied in grayscale, so don't memorize things by just color. That won't help you. No, by relationship to other structures. That's the best way to do that. Okay. I do think I want to say something else about membranes. Okay. But we'll get into membranes in just a little bit more detail. Let's look at the heart right here. I want to introduce this concept to you. Here we have the, what do we got right there? That is, you're right, there is a myocardium. Okay, another name for heart is myocardium. Cardia means heart, myo means muscle. This is a muscle that makes up the heart. What cavity is that in? That's in a cavity, right? It's not in an appendage. It's in the pericardial cavity. It's also in the mediastinum. It's also in the thoracic cavity, also in the ventral body cavity. But you're being really nice and precise. So let's think of the pericardial cavity. That's just the simple cavity that the heart is in. That cavity is not open to the outside world, and there is a system of membranes around the heart, and we call that a serous membrane. Anytime we have a cavity that's not open to the outside world, it has a serous membrane that has three parts associated with it. And I can see the three parts on this diagram. Maybe I'm going to blow this diagram up just a little bit more. Okay. So here I see a membrane, then I see a space that's filled with fluid, and then right on the surface of the heart, I see another membrane. So a serous membrane, all serous membranes have these three parts. The part that's right on the surface of that internal organ, okay, is called the visceral serous membrane, and since it's on the heart, we call that the visceral pericardium, because it's on the heart, right? The one that's removed from that visceral organ, that's the parietal pericardium. So here's the parietal pericardium. Here's the visceral pericardium right on the surface of that organ. And it's a visceral organ, so that's what we call that, the visceral pericardium. And the space right here in the middle is just the pericardial space filled with a serous fluid. All right, so that holds the heart in position. And it does a couple of other things, because what's your heart doing all the time? It's just hanging there? It's pumping blood. And it's pretty radical when it pumps. It beats a lot. It could beat itself up. It could get all inflamed. But these membrane systems absorbs the shock, right? Holds the heart in position so inflammation does not take place. Right? That serous fluid helps absorb the shock of contraction. This serous fluid can become infected, or it can become inflamed, and it can start to fill up with fluid, and you should probably know what that disease state is called. when the pericardial membranes become inflamed or infected, that's called pericarditis. Pericarditis, inflammation of the pericardium. And then fluid builds up in this space. Instead of being maybe just 5 millimeters to a centimeter thick, maybe it can be a centimeter and a half or 2 or 3 centimeters thick. All right, and can you imagine when the shape of this serous membrane changes? What does that mean? The function is going to change, the function of the heart is going to change, and if you think about it, you could probably figure it out, but maybe we'll just talk about it really fast. All right, in order for the heart to pump blood, all right, contraction is very important, but that's only one part of the heart phase. The other part is the heart has to relax, because in order for the heart to pump blood, what has to happen during relaxation? When the heart relaxes, it has to fill with blood, so that when it contracts, it pumps blood. When the heart relaxes, if it can't dilate, it can't fill with blood, so that even though it's maybe contracting normally, it won't pump any blood. So when there's pericarditis, inflammation of this membrane right here, it compresses the heart, so blood can't get into it, so the heart can't pump blood. That's a really serious circumstance, okay, pericarditis. How would you treat that? You just jab a needle in there and suck that fluid out, okay, and somebody feels better automatically. But you need a little training to do that kind of stuff, right, because you don't want to put the needle in the heart right here. Okay, some other organs in the thorax, all right, would be the lungs, all right, so here are the lungs. Oh, that's not exactly the picture that I wanted. It's really close. I guess that's what we're going to use. Okay? Let's really zoom in to this region right here. All right? The lungs are not open to the outside world. Okay? The inside of the lungs are, but not the outside of the lungs. So that's a serous membrane. So here we see three membranes again. I'm just really zooming into the lungs. Right on the surface of the lungs is the visceral serous membrane. But what cavity are the lungs in? They're not in the pericardial cavity. They're in the pleural cavity, so this would be the visceral pleura, okay? Right lining the chest wall right here would be the parietal pleural membrane, and in between them is going to be the pleural space. And an inflammation in this area right here is not pericarditis, we call that pleurisy, right? Pleurisy. And that can fill up with fluid, become inflamed, and you actually have some really good pain receptors in this region right here, and so you just won't be able to inhale when you have pleurisy. So how do you feel when you can't inhale? Okay, let's all hold our breath for 5 minutes. Let's see how that feels. How does that feel? Well, miserable. Okay, so somebody with pleurisy is really, really miserable because when they inhale, it feels like somebody's stabbing them with a knife in their chest, and that's not good. But if you hold your breath, you don't feel the stabbing in your chest, you feel just as miserable because you feel like you're dying because you're choking. So you don't have any really good options. So what do you do for patients that are in intractable pain? No matter what they do, they're in pain. Opiates, okay? That's a good standard therapy, and somebody with pleurisy probably needs some opiates as well as treating this infection right here. And if there's a big effusion, if the lungs are really filled up with a lot of fluid, then of course they can't get air into their lungs to breathe. And again, that fluid, what's the easiest, fastest way to get rid of that fluid? Jab a needle in there, suck it out. Okay? And somebody will thank you immediately because they can start to breathe again. Okay? But of course you can't forget to treat the underlying cause. All right, so the pericardial serous membrane, the pleural serous membrane, and all of the organs in the abdominal pelvic cavity have the same system of membranes around them. There's a membrane right on the surface of those visceral organs. That's what we would call the visceral peritoneum. Okay, and the one that's lining the muscle wall of the abdominal cavity, that would be the parietal peritoneum. All right, so I'm going to tell you about those serous membranes again, because it's so important to know. All right, so we can now move on to chapter 2, which are cells. And what can you tell me about cells? It's the structural and functional unit of what? Of life. That's right. That's really important. All right, I just closed the folder down that I wanted to look at. Rats. Where's that at? Over here. All right, so that's chapter 2. Get your chapter 2 notes out. All right, so we got a couple lectures on the cell because it's so important. And I don't like the way we're seeing this one. Zoom, let's make it a little bit bigger. Okay, the cell. All right, so if something is alive, it means it has to be built out of cells. So the cells, or a cell is the basic structural and functional unit of life. Life is a really complicated thing. All right, so we're going to look at some of the things that make a cell. We're going to break a cell down into its component parts. Okay, so here is a pretty good, well, it's a beautiful exam figure, all right, but it's a pretty good picture of a cell, a generalized cell. A cell might not have all of these things, and there's only a couple things that a cell might also have that's not on this diagram, but this is a pretty good place to start. Okay, and where we should start is the plasma membrane. This separates all the living things inside the cell from the extracellular environment, which may or may not be alive. In us, it's kind of alive, but right in other unicellular organisms, that's just the environment out over here. So it keeps living processes separated from non-living processes. Really important kind of structure. We're going to take a look at some detail of the plasma membrane. Some other things that we recognize is here is the nucleus. It has a membrane around it, just like the cell has a membrane around it. It protects DNA. You don't want any damage to occur to this DNA because this is the blueprint on how to build your body. And if this is the fundamental underlying blueprint on how to make your body, it also means that's the blueprint on how your body does what? If it determines the structure, it determines the function of that particular cell as well. So if this information is lost, the cell changes its shape, chances are the cell is going to die because it can't perform the right functions anymore. So the DNA inside the nucleus has to be protected. That DNA, sometimes we call it chromatin. Chromatin can make up chromosomes. Here is a dark part inside the nucleus. We call that the nucleolus. That's the active part of the nucleus. This is where RNA is being made. And we'll look at that process in just a little bit. What other kinds of things do we see? Mitochondria right here. Kind of look like little bean-shaped structures with membranes inside of them. All right, this is what we call the powerhouse of the cell. It's responsible for a number of important things, but the most important thing, if I were to just to pick one, is that it makes a molecule that we talked about last time, and that is ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and that is the energy currency inside the cell. Like if you go to the grocery store, you might have something very valuable, like your watch. And how many loaves of bread can you buy with your watch? Well, who's going to know, right? The checkout person isn't going to know. It's going to be worth something, all right? So what do you have to carry around with you? Not just valuables like gold rings and watches and things like that. You have to carry, like, dollar bills with you. Dollar bills, right, up here work as currency. So ATP that's made by mitochondria will work as an energy source for all of these different processes inside the cell. And mitochondria take glucose, which contains a lot of energy, and converts it into what? Dollar bills for all these organelles to use. Okay, so it's like a little exchanger right here, but it helps power the cell. Okay. Centrioles we see right here. We see endoplasmic reticulum with some other little organelles on there. Kind of looks like sandpaper, so we call that rough endoplasmic reticulum. Here is some endoplasmic reticulum that doesn't have a rough surface to it, so we call that smooth. So we're going to talk about the functions of these various things. So let's start by looking at the cell membrane right here, and then we'll take these organelles one at a time. Okay. So all membranes kind of have this basic shape. You can see basically it's made up of two layers right here. And you see two layers here. Here's a layer. Here's a layer. All membranes, whether they're surrounding the nucleus or endoplasmic reticulum, or the cell membrane, all have this basic structure. Sometimes we call that the phospholipid bilayer, bilayer meaning two layers. And if we look way over here, this right here is just a little phosphate group, and then this part is a lipid group. All right, so that's why we call this molecule, and you can see that unit repeating over and over and over again. Sometimes we call that a phospholipid. When you get into a physiology class, you'll learn a lot more about that phospholipid in all kinds of different ways and how membranes are assembled. But for right now, you should probably just know that's a phospholipid, and a membrane has these two layers to it. So that's the very elementary, simple way to know something about a membrane. You would just call it a phospholipid bilayer. But do you see other things in this membrane besides phospholipids? Do you see anything else in there? Maybe there's different colors of stuff, like this thing here, and these things in here, and these other things right here. So, a better understanding of a membrane, okay, is not just a phospholipid bilayer, which is the basic, very simple way a membrane is put together. You should understand that a cell membrane should be described as a fluid mosaic model. All right? The phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. Like if you were to drop some oil on a surface of water, what would happen to that drop of oil? Would it dissolve into the water? No, as a matter of fact, it would stay right on the surface and float on the surface. And if you were to jiggle that glass of water, what would happen to that oil layer? Would it crack and fracture? Or what would it do? It would jiggle and wiggle right on the surface of the water. It's very fluid, just like the water is very fluid. The same thing with this membrane here. It's very fluid. But the mosaic part means that there are other things added to the membrane, sometimes to give it a little bit of stiffness. Like, for instance, this cholesterol molecule right here is placed in the membrane to give the cell membrane a little rigidity so that when you stand up, all of your cells just don't run out on the floor. Right? That would be terrible if that were to happen. Right? Okay. There can be proteins added to the membrane. Here are what we call integral proteins. These are what we call integral because they're actually an internal feature of the membrane that if we were to take this protein out, we would actually destroy the membrane. So here is an integral protein that goes all the way from the outside to the inside of the cell, and you can see that there's a little channel through it. So that this integral protein we call a channel protein. This is the way that the cell can either export or let certain compounds enter or leave the cell. And the cell has the ability to open and close this particular channel depending on its needs. Right? So it can regulate things from the outside environment coming in or things going out. Here's another integral protein with a peripheral protein stuck on the top of it. Some of these right here can be used for receptors. It can watch for signaling compounds that bump into the cell like hormones that will then change the activity inside the cell. All right, so these can be receptors. Sometimes proteins have sugar molecules, these little things that look like stop signs are sugar molecules coming off this protein. So this is not just a simple protein. We call it a glycoprotein. Glyco meaning standing for sugar and protein. They're put together. A sugar molecule and a protein molecule are put together. And this is just an identifier based on the shape. It kind of looks like a Y with a little bend in it right here. So all cells in this particular body that this cell came from will have the same structure of a glycolipid on the cell surface so that the body knows that this particular cell belongs to the body and it doesn't come from some other person or some other animal. So it's an identifier that says that it belongs to the body. This is what we would call an antigen, right? And almost all cells have antigens on them, whether they're bacteria or human cells. So that's how you know that a cell belongs to your body, okay? So if you get a transplant maybe from your brother or sister, you know, chances are it's going to be rejected unless it's a perfect match, and that's because the shape of this sugar molecule is a little bit different. But it's not going to be much different, but somebody from outside your family is going to be a lot different. All right, a different species. The shape of this molecule is going to even be a lot more different. Bacteria is going to be totally different, so your body can recognize what belongs and what doesn't belong there. So if a red blood cell, like a macrophage, bumps into a cell that has an antigen on it with an inappropriate shape, what's going to happen to that cell? Yeah, that macrophage is going to destroy the cell because it doesn't belong there. Maybe it's a tumor cell. The red blood cell will destroy it. Hopefully that will happen. Sometimes tumor cells figure out a way to defeat that mechanism and then it becomes a problem. Then a person has cancer, for instance, or possibly. Okay, so you have the basic phospholipid bilayer, but attached to that phospholipid bilayer are other proteins or modifications of proteins that change the function of this membrane, maybe for transport or for recognition or communication, for instance, if it's a receptor. So all those things are really important. You're going to spend a lot of time in physiology learning about that kind of stuff. Okay, so this is the extracellular environment. That's outside the cell. Here is the intracellular environment. And both of these environments right here are basically all dissolved in water. The inside of the membrane right here doesn't contain any water. This is the oily part of your body, right? So things that dissolve in oil will dissolve in this part of the membrane, but water won't, right? So that's why this thing acts as a nice barrier between the outside world and your inside world of your cells. And you probably use that at home. How would you use that at home? Like for cooking, a cooking example. What would you use a little oil barrier for? Well, say you're going to have a party, or you had a party Friday night, and you're going to serve some crackers with a little caviar on top, some capers, little slices of lemon or something. Would you put, and the caviar is in water, and a lemon slice is all in water. What would happen if you were just put that on a cracker? What would happen to the cracker? Well, it just turned to mush, right? So by the time you reach to pick one up and eat it, you just have mush. So how do you protect the cracker from all the water stuff on top of it? Well, just put a little bit of oil on top of the cracker and then put the watery stuff on top of it, and then you have a nice crunchy cracker and all the good stuff on top of it, you know, even an hour later. All right, so that's the job of this membrane right here, because it's phospholipid, right? That's a nice barrier for water compartments. Okay, so that's the cell membrane. So let's look at some other organelles that we have right here. And I probably won't go down this list. I'll try to follow this list a little bit. Okay, rough endoplasmic reticulum. We see kind of bending around the cell. So this is a really good exam figure, so make sure you can label this, but also know the functions of these organelles. The function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is to make proteins. That's one important major kind of biomolecule in your body. I don't want to say organic, but biomolecule. And you have three other kinds of important biomolecules. You have proteins, and you have lipids, which we talked about. You have another one we talked about, sugars. And then one we haven't, well, we sort of talked about it, but also nucleic acids, which make DNA and chromatin. So you got proteins. As a matter of fact, you probably know some of the building blocks of proteins. What's a building block of a protein? Amino acid, probably you've heard of that. Okay, and then you've got lipids. We won't talk about building blocks of lipids until you get into physiology. Nucleic acids, right? You'll have to learn building blocks of that in another class. And sugars, right? And a building block of a sugar is just a monosaccharide, a simple sugar like glucose. All right, those are the basic building blocks. So the rough endoplasmic reticulum has the ability to take amino acids, join them together to make a protein. That's its job. And there's a couple different fates for that protein. Sometimes it can stay inside the cell. Other times it can actually leave the cell. It can be secreted. Well, I'll talk about that after we get done talking about all of the organelles. So rough ER, protein synthesis. Smooth ER, lipid synthesis, a different kind of compound altogether. Right? Lipids don't dissolve in water, but that's the job of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Like, for instance, what might be a good molecule that smooth endoplasmic reticulum can build? Do you need lipids inside your cells or your body? For what reason? How about the phospholipid membrane? In order to make membranes, the smooth endoplasmic reticulum has to be there making lipids, just so that you can make membranes. All right, the mitochondria does what? Makes ATP. From glucose primarily, as well as some building blocks of fats like fatty acids, it can make ATP. The Golgi apparatus, or Golgi body, will take proteins that are made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum, all right, and then modify them. It can add a sugar molecule to it, making it a glycoprotein, all right, and then it can package it into this vesicle right here. And then that vesicle can move over to the plasma membrane, fuse with it, and then will release that material outside of the cell. So that's what we call a secretory pathway, where something is made by the rough ER, namely a protein, that it moves into the Golgi apparatus where it's modified, and then that product is put into a vesicle where it is secreted from the cell. So if you're going to say something about the Golgi apparatus right here, it's got two main functions. It's for modification and packaging. Modification and packaging. So it modifies proteins and turns it into like a glycoprotein, and it packages it into these vesicles right here. That's the job of Golgi. Okay, now the thing that makes the rough endoplasmic reticulum different from smooth are these little dots. And those little dots right there are ribosomes. And you have to know the function of a ribosome. That is the unit right there that can make a protein. So think of a ribosome as the workbench where somebody's working putting amino acids together to make a protein. And they're attached to the surface of rough ER. You can also see ribosomes interspersed throughout the cytoplasm right here. And the job of these is also to make proteins. Now these don't end up going outside the cell. Their fate is to stay inside the cell within the cytoplasm their whole life. Proteins that are made by rough ER can be secreted from the cell. Proteins that are made by these free ribosomes are stuck inside the cell. But that's okay, because you need important proteins inside the cell doing their jobs too. Right? So you got two different fates for proteins, depending on where they're made. Right? If rough ER, they can leave. Free ribosomes, they stay inside the cell. All right, these little bubbles inside the cell, there's a lot of little bubbles. They have different names. This one right here, this is what we call a peroxisome. And a peroxisome contains enzymes that can detoxify certain kinds of compounds. All right, like peroxidase, I don't think you have to know the name of that enzyme, but you should know a peroxisome, key term is what? Detoxification. All right, so your cell does produce some toxic chemicals sometimes that can produce cell death or damage. The job of a peroxisome is to gobble those things up. For instance, maybe you've heard of free radicals. You don't have a picture in your mind of what a free radical is. That's okay. But a peroxisome can detoxify some free radicals, which can damage your cell. Another kind of vesicle, well, here's a secretory vesicle. All right, here is a peroxisome. There's also something called an endosome. No, lysosome. Here's a lysosome. Lysosome, I see some particles inside of it. And sometimes a bacteria can get inside the cell and cause pathology, but this lysosome sometimes can move around and surround the bacteria, and there are digestive enzymes inside the lysosome. So guess what happens to the bacteria? It gets broken down. And when it gets broken down, changes shape. This means it's no longer alive, can no longer cause infection. So lyse means to break something down. A lysosome is a intracellular digestive system that can break cells down into smaller fragments, or even large molecules down into smaller molecules. Maybe even large proteins down into amino acids, right? That's the job of a lysosome. So peroxisome, detoxification. Lysosome would be, what's the one word for lysosome? Okay, detoxification is peroxisome. But what about lysosome? Digestion. Or if you want to say lysis, that's fine. This is a little bit more sophisticated kind of term. Okay. One thing I haven't mentioned, I don't think, during lecture right here is everything inside the cell membrane is what we call cytoplasm, including these organelles that we have just been talking about. But there's another component to cytoplasm besides organelles. It's also the fluid part of the material inside the cell membrane. Just the water that all the proteins and sugars are dissolved in, that's actually suspend the organelles. And that water part of cytoplasm is what we call cytosol. Right? So cytoplasm, if we're going to write this down on the board, let's see if the microphone behaves. Cytoplasm, okay, is equal to what? Cytosol. And then what else do we want to put there? Minus, divide, add, plus, what? Organelles. All right, so organelles plus cytosol make cytoplasm. That's all the living junk inside the cell. That's everything in there. Okay. Golgi body. We got Golgi body right here. Oh, what did we say about Golgi body? What, two words? Modification and packaging. All right, so modifying a protein into a complex sugar protein and then packaging into a secretory vesicle, for instance. Lysosome for digestion. Mitochondria makes ATP. Ah, centrioles. Okay, most of the organelles that we've talked about so far have a membrane around them. Okay, like the nucleus has a membrane around them, the cell has a membrane, Golgi, endoplasmic reticulum, the mitochondria even has two membranes around it. All these vesicles have a membrane. There are some organelles that don't have membranes around them. What are these centrioles right here? Centrioles are made out of microtubules, and they help organize the microtubule system inside the cell. And here we can see microtubules kind of flaring out away from the centrioles. And microtubules are like a railway system inside the cell. Okay, what would you use a railroad for? Yeah, transport from one place to the country to another place. Okay, shipping stuff around. All right, but now this railway system doesn't have two rails, it just has one. But that's no big deal because have you ever been on a train that only had one rail? Some of you have, I'm sure. Where would you go for that? Yeah, you would go to Disneyland. So if you haven't been on a monorail, if you want to, you can just go down there and see what it looks like. All right, so these microtubules right here is like a monorail system inside the cell. So a vesicle can attach to a microtubule and it can be moved around. Right? It can go from Golgi over to the cell membrane. Right? Or these mitochondria can be placed around in different parts of the cell. And these microtubules can push and pull on the cell membrane, can give the cell a particular kind of shape, right? Which might have some inference on what its structure is, right? You change the shape of the cell, the structure is going to change. And what arranges and controls all these microtubules are the centrioles right here. So I see two centrioles. We put two centrioles together, we get the centrosome complex or centrosome matrix. All right, so that could, you could say that's important for transportation. It helps determine the shape of the cell. And when we get to other things about the cell, like mitosis, you see why they're going to be important. Okay, some things that are not on this slide, unfortunately, I don't have a picture of, but sometimes you'll see an extension, watch the cursor on the picture, right? You'll see an extension of the cytoplasm, right? In anatomy, you call that a process, something sticking out of something that's a process. You might see like a stick sticking out right here, all right? And inside that stick are going to be microtubules. And those things that are sticking out, sometimes they move around, and those would be cilia. All right, so cilia are projections, and a cell might have a couple hundred cilia sticking out, and they all sweep and bead in a certain direction. All right, and so that's going to cause some flow to occur over the surface of the cell. So the purpose of cilia would be motility. It's going to move something around. A flagellum is one. A cell might have a flagellum, and it might be maybe 20 or 30 times as long as a cilia. So it would stick way out. So I can see why they didn't put a flagellum on this cell, because it would be a couple books, a couple seats down from you, right? It'd be really long. But it's important for motility as well. And there's only one cell in the human body that has that, and that, of course, is the sperm cell, right? That's the special reproductive cells that males produce. And that's the only one that has a flagellum. And again, that sperm can swim around in its environment because of that flagellum right there. Microvilli, on the other hand, are really small, a lot smaller than a cilium. And of course, the cilium is even a lot smaller than a flagellum, right? And microvilli are just small folds of the surface membrane. So they all kind of look the same, unless you can compare them side by side, right? And the job of microvilli right here is for absorption. So there's certain parts in your body where you need to have enhanced absorption of materials. Can anybody think of an area, a part of your body where you want to have good, efficient absorption of materials? Like your digestive tract. Yeah, the cells that line your digestive tract have microvilli so they can absorb nutrients in the food that you eat and get it inside your body. Okay, so we went over some good bullet points of all these different organelles right here. I don't think I missed anything real important. Well, you might be asking the question, why is this cell so complicated? Why does it have all these different organelles right here? Why isn't it just all kind of mixed together? And then we don't have to worry about all this stuff and learn all the particular functions. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Why are they all there? I like questions like that. I usually have to think about them for 5 or 6 years, so you guys don't have a chance in just one period. Okay. But does anybody have a thought? Okay. Well, think of this cell right here as not being a cell, but being this building, the SEM building. And when you walk in the SEM building, what do you have? Do you have just one big amphitheater, or what do you have? You've got all kinds of different rooms, right? And why do you have all those different rooms? Because if it was one big amphitheater, this would be really cool if it would work, but it wouldn't work. If it was just one big room, you could take a physics class, you could take an anatomy class, and physiology, and micro, and some engineering, and maybe an English class, all at the same time. Because you'd have all those classes going on all at one time, but how much would you learn? Nothing. All right, and why is that? Because there would be interference, right? My lecture would interfere with somebody else's lecture. It would just be a bunch of noise, okay? So this cell right here has all these different organelles so that this process of making, what does this guy make? What's the name of this guy right here? That's a mitochondria. What does it make? Proteins? No, it makes ATP. So this mitochondria, when it's making ATP, it's busy. It doesn't interfere with rough endoplasmic reticulum when it's making a protein. Because if it did, what would happen to the life processes? Would get messed up. So specialization of all these organelles allows various functions to happen inside the cell at the exact same time without interference. That's the purpose of organelles. So very simple life forms that don't have organelles really can't compete very well against more complicated cells, like we call eukaryotic cells that make up our body, have all these specializations so that various functions can take place all at the same time without interfering with each other. So that's why we got them. So it's a good thing that we do. Okay. All right, so what else do we talk about in this chapter? Okay. So here's the nucleus again, and you can see that there are holes in the membrane. And this allows particles to move in and out of the membrane. Some we'll see what moves in and out of the membrane in just a little bit. The nucleus is the active part of the nucleus. The nucleus protects DNA. And this cell right here, if I look in this region, I don't see much in the way of any kind of structure. It looks very homogeneous, just kind of a blue color, hopefully blue, might be purple or something, but homogeneous color. That means that all the DNA is spread out all over inside the nucleus and it's being used to make proteins. I don't see any chromosomes. That's because the nucleus is active right now. It's not undergoing mitosis. Okay. So we're going to talk about that in this lecture, this chapter pretty soon. Let's talk about movement across the plasma membrane. All right, what can you tell me about the stuff that's inside the cell compared to the stuff that's outside the cell? Are they the same? Or a little bit different, or what? As a matter of fact, just think about temperature. What's the temperature inside you compared to the room? Is it the same? No, it can be radically different, right? It could be below zero, and as long as you're 98.6, you're fine, right? And that is true for the concentration of various chemicals. The pH, which is the acidity, can be radically different outside the cell compared to inside of the cell, and it's the job of this plasma membrane to make sure that they stay separate because these living processes are radically different, are operating under radically different conditions than what's in the extracellular environment. Nonetheless, there has to be communication. There has to be transport across the membrane. So let's talk about how things move into the cell, how things move out of the cell, and maybe how that is controlled a little bit. So there are basically two ways that we can talk about membrane transport. There are passive processes and active processes. All right, and a passive process does not require any energy for that to happen. It's just something that happens automatically. Okay, like for instance, if you were to stand on that stair right there, maybe halfway up the room, all right, and then faint, which way would you fall? Would you fall up and end up at the top of the class, or when you fainted, would you fall down? You would always fall down. You would never fall up, right? Falling down is a passive process. It just happens automatically, all right? And two processes that are automatic in the body are diffusion and osmosis, which is a special kind of diffusion. So what does diffusion mean? It means that if we have, let's think of this. How about a perfume bottle that I have right here? And perfume, if I open up the bottle cap, it's going to evaporate into the air. Okay? And then if you walk by that perfume bottle, of course, you can smell it and you can know, oh, there's perfume there. So it's a molecule that you can actually sense with your nose. And in this room right here, do you see a fan moving or anything? Are there currents? I don't feel any air moving around at all. But even in the room with no air currents, if I were to open up that perfume bottle, the perfume would dissolve into the air, and then it would actually move through the whole room, even though there's nothing moving it around. It would move automatically all by itself. And the way it's going to move is from high concentration near the bottle to low concentration, which is where? Way in the back of the room. So people in the front row would smell it first, and then the second row and third row. Okay, and then finally, if we were to leave that perfume bottle open for all week during lecture and we walked in the room, guess what? We'd smell it in the back, the very last row, and it would be the same concentration as the front. Okay, and when it's the same concentration, then the molecules would stop moving. So in order for molecules to move, there has to be a concentration gradient. There's got to be a difference in concentration. And diffusion then will make it all homogeneous, will iron it out, will make it the same concentration everywhere. And when it's the same concentration everywhere, then diffusion stops because the concentration gradient, changes in concentration, is the force for moving that molecule around, even though there is nothing moving it. So if there is a molecule at high concentration outside the cell and low inside, what does that molecule like to do? It will like to move from outside to inside, just by the concentration gradient. Some molecules can't. If they can't get through that lipid membrane, then they can't get through. But if there is a channel, like we showed you, that protein molecule, then it can move inside the cell. And when will it stop moving inside the cell? As soon as the concentration is the same inside and outside, and then it will stop. Okay. Osmosis is diffusion. That means there has to be a concentration difference from one side of the membrane to the other. And osmosis is particular for only one kind of molecule, not perfume or any other kind of molecule. It has to be the water molecule. And water is what? The solvent molecule that we're all dissolved in, that has all the dissolving properties. And it can move in and out of most cells of your body. And it will move according to a concentration gradient. So if you're dehydrated and water leaves the extracellular space, guess what? Water will leave these cells right here and go into the extracellular space. That's pretty dangerous when that happens, right? When you become dehydrated. Or if you're really super hydrated and water concentration gets really high outside the cell, it can move in. What happens when you blow air into a balloon? What happens to the balloon? Does it change shape? Yeah, it blows up, right? And if you put too much air inside of a balloon, what happens to it? It pops. As a matter of fact, if there's too much water outside of the cell and it osmoses into the cell, so much water can move inside the cell that it will actually explode. And you can imagine what that's like if that happens all over a person's body, right? That's immediately fatal, right? That's what happens. So if you get a shot with the wrong kind of concentration of water in there, you could be blowing up red blood cells. That's really important. When we get into physiology, we talk about that. We call that hemolysis. So things can move passively just by concentration gradient. So where we're going to start next time is an active process. And what does active mean? Yeah, it takes energy. You got to like plug something into the wall. You got to fill a gas tank up. It's going to take an energy molecule. And for you, what's that energy molecule? That's right. It's ATP. Where do you get that from? Mitochondria. Cool. Okay, so that's where we're going to start next time.